Buenos días. That's about as much Spanish as I know. No. Today I'm going to talk about the future of software, or in Espanol, el futuro del software. And you might be thinking, predicting the future of software, like that seems pretty ambitious, kind of ridiculous. I mean, 100 years ago, who could have predicted the internet or anything like that? In fact, I can't even predict what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. So how will I predict the future of software? I mean, I can predict that it will probably be muy sabrosa. See, I know a little bit more. I actually lived in Spain for 3 years, so I picked up un poquito español. So today I want to kind of talk about what the future of software holds. You know, are we all going to be batteries for the robots? How many of you know this movie? Anyone here not know this movie? Because I always wonder about cultural references. Okay. Well, it turns out that we can get a good idea of what the future holds because there are certain techniques for predicting the future. For example, we can roll dice. I joke, but it's a common belief that innovation just sort of comes out of nowhere, right? Like one day there's not this thing, and then the next day, out of nowhere, this brand new thing, completely original idea comes into the world. But we know that that's actually not how innovation happens. That's never been how it's worked historically. For example, let's talk about the telephone. You've probably heard the story about how Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. But did you know that there's this other gentleman, Elisha Gray, who also invented a telephone? In fact, he went to the patent office the same day that Alexander Graham Bell went to in order to patent the telephone. And I think he missed it by a few hours. Plus, there was some political backstabbing that went on, as often, you know, the story behind the story is. But the point is that it wasn't that the telephone came out of nowhere. It was that it reflected the needs of the time, if it reflected the environment and the trends. So if we look at the past and the present, we can start to extrapolate on what the future may hold. But first, a little bit about me. My name is Phil Hack. I work at GitHub. I manage three teams there, Atom, Desktop, and Visual Studio. And I keep a blog at hacked.com, so if you're curious to read about what I like to write about. And I'm also on Twitter and GitHub as @hacked. And I've been in love with computers since a very young age. My first computer was a TRS-80 color computer, affectionately known as the Trash 80. And you can see I looked very old for my age. I got that computer when I was around 5 or 6. And I've been in love with computers ever since. And computer science is really interesting because as a discipline of study, it's actually very young. So if we take a look at something like mathematics, which has been around a long time, you might say that mathematics started around 5,000 years ago in 3000 BC when the Babylonians and the ancient Greeks, or Egyptians, I'm sorry, started to codify the rules of math and study it for its own sake. And then chemistry, it was started around 1660 when a group of scientists such as Robert Boyle and Hooke and John Mayo began to shape chemistry into science, because before then, you know, it was alchemy and they didn't apply the scientific method to it. But computer science didn't really come around as a discipline until around the 1950s or early 1960s. So that tiny little orange slice there, that's how long computer science has been around in context with all the other things that as humans we have studied over time. So you can see, we're very, very early in this study. So kind of, I want to give we could spend days talking about the history of computing. So I had to pick and choose a few tidbits that I feel were significant, and this is just a tiny slice of the history of computing. And so, you know, early people, we counted on our fingers and then started to use the bone of a bamboo like this Ishango bone 60,000 years ago. And so you might call it the first instance of wearable computing, as that was a bone of a bamboo. And then around 5,000 years ago, we started to build more complex tools. So this is an abacus or a suan pan. What you'll notice that's really interesting here is that this was a hexadecimal, so base 16 counting instrument for doing arithmetic. And an expert could do about 5 to 10 digits per second. So that, you know, if you're curious, that translates to this number in decimal. So hexadecimal is, you know, 5,000 years old. And about 402 years ago, the first written reference to the word computer was first recorded. But computer didn't refer to a machine back then, it referred to people. So Alan Turing, famous computer scientist, noted that the human computer is supposed to follow rules. He has no authority to deviate from them, from any detail. And so that's pretty similar to how a computer today works. During World War II, for example, computers, AKA this room full of computers here, played a part in creating ballistic tables. So they'd calculate the trajectories of, you know, bombs that were being shot at the enemy. And it was very interesting because women dominated the computing industry in the early days because they were willing to work for about half what men were asking for. Today in the US, for example, like recent studies show that women programmers make about 95 cents to a dollar. So that's progress, but that's not equality yet. Around 395 years ago, the slide rule is invented. And so this is an analog computer used to do multiplication, division, roots, logs, trigonometry. You know, if you're really old, then you might have actually used this in school. I fortunately missed that. And then in 1801, this thing is invented. Joseph Marie Jacquard, he's a French weaver and merchant. And he developed this loom, the Jacquard loom, that was programmable. And so he could program patterns into it, and then it would automatically create these patterns. And he used punch cards to do that. So imagine writing code with one of these. Well, you'll see later that's exactly what we did. So in around 1840, there's this woman mathematician, Ada Lovelace, and she wrote the first algorithm intended to be run on a computer. The interesting thing, the computer was called the analytical engine, and it was invented by Charles Babbage. The interesting thing was that this computer was never created at the time. This was merely an theoretical machine that Charles Babbage had written the specification for, and it wasn't until like hundreds of years later that people were like, hey, could this computer have been built by Charles if he had had the funds and time to do it? And they were able to build it with very slight modifications to the plans, modifications that they believe Charles would have figured out as he tried to build it. So Ada was able to write code for a computer that didn't exist. And that sort of became the foundation for the twin fields of computer science and software engineering down in the future. If you want to see this, you can actually go to the London Science Museum in London or the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. And in Mountain View, they'll actually show it working, all the gears twisting. And it did a decimal arithmetic. So like you could actually see when you're adding numbers and you have to carry the one like to the tens, you see these like the 10 thing rotate around and click into place. It's really an interesting sight. So far, I've defined a computer as a person who follows instructions. What was the first computer where that we would call it a computer, like a machine that did calculation? Well, what's interesting is you might have heard of something called the ENIAC, but before even the ENIAC, 77 years ago, there's this guy, Conrad Zuse, who created the Z1 in his parents' living room. So I don't know about you. My parents let me play with Legos in the living room, but I don't think they would ever let me do something like this. He must have very patient parents. And the way this computer worked that was interesting is it was a mechanical computer, but it did binary arithmetic. And that meant it didn't need all this complex carrying gearing that the analytical engine did. And it ran on 35-millimeter stock. That's how it would be programmed through that through a roll of film. So how many of you even know what this thing is right here? So, you know, back in the old days, we used to have to pop that into a camera to take photos. Now it's all digital. It's much better now than before. This thing was unreliable, didn't really work too well. He never got a patent on it, so he was almost forgotten in obscurity. And then later, the Atanasoff-Berry computer was created, and this is the first electronic computer. So the previous one was mechanical, this one's electronic. It used vacuum tubes, digital computation, and it was the first to use capacitors to store data. Capacitors, if you're familiar with RAM, the things we use today, this was the thing that started that. And it was amazing. It was capable of performing 30 whole simultaneous operations. And it was a specific use computer. It was not Turing complete. It was just meant to solve systems of linear equations. The interesting part was they built it so that it could be wheeled out of the room and moved to other places, but they didn't take into consideration the door jams. So when they tried to wheel it out, it got stuck and they couldn't get it out of the room, so they ended up disassembling it for parts. So one of those, one of the first mechanical bugs, I guess you'd say. So the Colossus was the first electronic digital programmable computer, as in the program was put in the machine. And then there's the ENIAC. And this is the one that most people would say, oh, this is the first computer, because it's the first one that was general purpose. It was Turing complete. So you could pretty much write any kind of program for it. But note that, like, the way you programmed it was moving these, wires and twisting cable and all that stuff. So I always wondered, like, what did they argue about, before tabs and spaces? Like, the direction that you twist these wires? Who knows? So let's talk about the first program. So you remember that guy, Conrad Zuse, the guy who built the big thing in his parents' basement? He also worked on the first programming language, or first algorithmic programming language. And he was hoping to figure out a way to specify general purpose programming, what we do today, every day. What's really interesting about that syntax there is that it's two-dimensional. So, sometimes we sort of think the way we do things today is the only possible way to do it. But he kind of came up with this two-dimensional matrix that would form the code. So this, as an example, this is if you were to take that and make it a linear transcription, aka, line by line, this is how it would work. So a couple interesting things. You couldn't name variables anything you wanted. For example, they could only be V, R, or Z with indexes. This was, it was published way before anyone thought there was even a need for higher level languages. So it pretty much, it never caught on. And then in 1949, the language shortcode appeared, and it was the first computer language for electronic devices, but the programmer had to manually take these expressions and then manually compile them into ones and zeros. So you would do the substitution, and then you would have to substitute the symbols for the codes. You notice multiplication of the Y1 there is done by positioning, and then you would transcribe this into 12-byte words because those were used by UNIVAC and BINAC computers. And so you'd have to do this process manually, and that would be your end code. So imagine debugging that. That wouldn't be a lot of fun. That process really sucked. Thankfully, 63 years ago, the mathematician Grace Hopper came along, and she wrote A-0, the first compiler. So, if this task is very, very systematic, why not let a computer do it? And it possessed several features of a modern-day compiler, and it was written for the UNIVAC 1 computer, the first commercial business computer in the United States. And she's also the first person credited with the term bug in the context of computer programming. Speaking of bugs, I found this quote as I was researching the history of programming. I thought this was really interesting. This is by Maurice Wilkes, a British computer scientist who invented the concept of microprogramming. And he came up with the idea of symbolic labels. And he said, as soon as we started programming, we found to our surprise that it wasn't easy to get programs right as we had thought. Really? Debugging had to be discovered. I can remember the exact instance when I realized that a large part of my life from then on was going to be spent in finding mistakes in my own programs. See, we can predict the future of programming. And most of it is spent debugging. So in 1957, a team from IBM led by John Backes created Fortran. And so this is it used English-like statements, And there was a lot of people back then, you know, even now some people feel this way, that, oh, this will never compete with, like, you know, raw assembly language. But it actually performed really well, especially for scientific applications. And this is a punch card. Remember the Jacquard loom that I showed earlier? So this is the way you would program it. This is where we get, like, columns in our terminals from. You know, you have a set number of columns there that you could write your program. And then I remember when I was a kid, my dad used to bring these home from his work in the Air Force. And you'd write these programs, perhaps on paper, and then you'd punch them into the cards, submit them to a computer operator, and then hours, maybe days later, you would find out the results. For example, you might find out, oops, syntax error on line 3. And then you had to go through the process again. Imagine that loop, right? That'd be terrible. So this is an example of that, not that program, but a Fortran program in textual form. And you know, Fortran's still in use today, even though it was written so long ago. In fact, I had a job at Univision, the Spanish language television, for a little while where I wrote Visual Basic code to take Fortran 77 and convert it to a more modern Fortran, as if that makes sense. So there's a Fortran for .NET, for example. And then in 1958, you know, we get kind of the beginning of functional programming with Lisp around the same time as, or even earlier than some of the other object-oriented programming. And this is, Lisp is interesting because they basically just take the abstract syntax tree, you know, like the thing that normally is what you compile source code into before you compile it into machine language. So, you know, when you use Roslyn to like travel the syntax tree of a C# program, Lisp was basically already in that shape of the abstract syntax tree, and it was mainly used for artificial intelligence research. And then there's ALGOL. This is a language that was created by a committee for scientific use, but this is pretty much the predecessor of all the languages, many of the languages we use today, such as C, Basic, Pascal, Java. So I have a quick timeline here, kind of puts in perspective when languages were created. You'll note that a lot of people think of Ruby as being a relatively recent language, but it was created around the same time as Java, PHP, and JavaScript. C#, F#, very recent, and then Go and Swift. And then here's a timeline of some key events in computing history, such as when the first message was on ARPANET, the predecessor to the internet. We have Mosaic was the first graphical web browser, and then the iPhone came out and really started ushered in the mobile age. So that's kind of a real whirlwind tour. I've left a lot of things out, obviously, of the history that brought us to today. And what's the state of programming today? What do we struggle with? What themes do we see? Well, I think we see that software is exceedingly complex. As Maurice Wilkes mentioned earlier, we're spending so much time debugging. And to manage that complexity, we have to work together. People have to collaborate, work on software together. Software has become social. And so the company I work at, GitHub, is at the heart of that as well in terms of a place to collaborate on open source software or closed source. And sites like GitHub allow us to work on code together, manage that complexity as teams rather than individuals. And then not only do we collaborate on code, but we collaborate on teaching each other, right? The best way to learn is not only to try things, but to learn from other people. So we have sites like Stack Overflow. So this is a photo of the documentation for the left pad method you might have heard in the Node community. No, I'm kidding. This is Margaret Hamilton. She wrote code for the onboard flight software of the Apollo space program. And that's a printout of the source code. So it's great that we don't have to do that anymore. So let's talk about the future. So we have these themes that are kind of ongoing today that lead to the future. And I think a couple themes that I'm seeing, for example, is that the future is immersive, right? We have things like HoloLens, Oculus Rift. They're bringing us sort of into the computer, but also bringing the computer into our spaces as well, like in the case of HoloLens. Computers are becoming more conversational. We have, this is a photo of the Amazon Echo where you can kind of just talk to it and it will give you information, do things on your behalf. It's becoming autonomous. This is an example of one of Google's self-driving cars. In the future, a lot of code is going to be moving towards powering autonomous vehicles, autonomous systems. And then immediacy is very important. You know, I mentioned the, you know, how you would write and debug a Fortran program where a cycle could, take hours if not days just for a simple program. Today, you know, software is tending to be more immediate and more visual, where the feedback cycle of what you're thinking and what you're trying to do and the result is becoming shorter and shorter than ever. So what I want to do now is I'll show you a demo of some software that you can start using today that I feel hint towards what the future is going to look like, or the near-term future of software is going to look like. So let's see if I can switch over here. Oh, still on the... Oh, am I not presenting? Here, let me draw that. Oh, okay, great. You can see that. So everyone's favorite coding example, I've written a something called FizzBuzz. And I'm going to use something called nCrunch here. So what nCrunch does, So nCrunch is some third-party software that you can go out and you can get a trial, you can buy it. But what it does is it provides an immediate feedback loop on your unit tests. So for example, it ran all my tests, and right here, if I click this, can you guys see that? Let me zoom in here a little bit. You can see here that it expected fizz, but it got fuzz. So let's zoom out, and then I'm going to fix the code that caused that bug. So here it is on line 14. I wrote fuzz, I meant fizz. So in the US, fuzz is also slang for a police officer. So, you know, like, the, watch out for the fuzz, the fuzz. So next time you're in the US, you'll know what to say. So now I'm changing that, and I'm going to hit Control S. I'm saving the file. And then I'll wait a second here. And you'll see that the test already updated automatically. See that? I didn't have to switch over, run all my tests again. It just automatically picked up the change, ran the affected test, and I immediately know that the test is now passing. So, you know, as part of the way I might continue to code, I might say, oh, well, let's add a new test. Now, I'm lazy, so I'm just going to uncomment this pre-existing test. What this test does is this is making sure that if you pass in -1 or some negative number into this method, it's going to throw an, it should throw a proper exception. And we can see that it doesn't. It's, the test fails. So I write the test, and then I will go in here and fix the code. So if iterations less than 0, we'll throw a new argument exception. Oh, wait, argument out of range exception. And because I'm using C#6, I get to use the name of operator, which I'm really happy about. Now I save that, and wait a second, you see the test updates. What's nice is I can keep my hands on the keyboard, keep my hands in the code, and the test will automatically run and update and tell me, like, give me an immediate feedback loop. So I really like that immediacy. So another thing I want to show you is an extension called Come Alive. So what Come Alive does is it gives you some immediate feedback into how your code will run. And I'll show you what I mean by that in a second. So I'm going to actually hit play on this main method. And you can see here that main takes in an array of arguments. And so this is asking me, well, what do I want to pass in for main? So let's pass in a single argument of 10 here, and I'll just delete this one. And then I'm going to launch Come Alive. So now what's really cool about Come Alive is as I start coding, it's going to visualize the values and the way data flows through my program. that doesn't make sense. I'll just show it to you. So for example, this program you pass in iterations as a string. I want to get that as an integer. So I'll do int iterations equals 32. And then we'll take args of 0. Now, do you see this over here on the right? It's figuring out like what these values are and showing them to me based on what I configured earlier. So let's write, let's generate some entries, okay? So var entries equals new fizzBuzzinator. So we'll use the passing iterations, and I'll call two lists to generate that. And then you can see over here on the right, we can see the entries already being populated. And so I can do this. I can go, this one's really cool. So for each var entry in entries, result plus, let's create a string to hold the result. And then result plus equals, in real life I'd probably use a string builder, maybe not, but this is demo code, so remember that. Please don't judge me. And then we're going to console.writeLine result. Okay, so I have a syntax error. What is this? So you can see here that it's populated the list, it populated the entry, and result is right now the value of the first iteration. But I can go here, I'm going to zoom in on that, and I can start moving through the iterations. See the results increase? And boom. So that is a profoundly interesting way of visualizing the code as without having to constantly stop, compile, run it, see what happens. Like, I can see what's happening as I write it. Now, this might be my understanding of this extension. There are some limitations today that I think hopefully we'll solve tomorrow. Thank you, Cortana. For example, if you're doing everything through expressions, it gets a little bit harder to visualize the data as it goes through. But I think it's just a matter of time where, this will work just as equally as good with link and reactive extensions as it does with, for loops. But a really interesting extension. It's called Come Alive. You can check it out. So the next demo is, I think our editor. So this is actually my demo notes here. Editors are changing. So this is the Atom editor, something that we built at GitHub. It's open source, free. You can check it out. And what's cool about Atom is that it's built on a technology called Electron that's JavaScript, CSS, and HTML based. And what that means is that you can hack your environment, no relation to me, you can hack your environment and have the changes happen immediately. So I'm going to bring up Alt-Control-I. How many of you here are web developers? So most of you are familiar with like developer tools in the browser. So, okay. What just happened? Okay, I'm afraid. Okay, here we go. This is Alt-Control-I. Okay, let's do this. Okay. All right, so this is the developer tools, just like you would have in Chrome. But imagine having this for something like Visual Studio, right? So I'm going to cheat here and show you that, for example, I can programmatically change the font of my editor. Whee! And now it's Papyrus, which is a beautiful, beautiful font. If you're having trouble seeing that, I'll change the, I didn't want to type all this in. But you have full access to the Atom API. Okay, let's. Okay, this was funny, but I need to change it back because I cannot read that. And let's go to 24 is reasonable. Or let's go 12. Okay. And then, you have I can even insert text here, so I'll just do this. I don't know where this is going to insert it, though, but probably right there. And we can see, hello, Peru. So this is immediate feedback. So I can hack my editor, customize it to the way I want to work, and see it run immediately. What's also cool, and I think something that's happening in the future, is that this is a text editor that runs on your local machine. There's also something called Cloud9 that I want to show you real quick. And so Cloud9 is an IDE, or integrated development environment, that runs in the cloud or in your browser. So I can start this up. I have this sample project. This is one of their base sample projects. It's a Node.js application. And I'm going to run this. And we'll see that it sets up a website where I can actually navigate and check out this code running in the cloud. And this is basically a chat engine. So I can say, act, hola, Peru. And we'll see what happened. Oh, so notice I have a breakpoint set. So this is all running in the browser. I have a breakpoint set here. I can highlight this, and I can see the data. And a very cool interactive experience. What's really interesting here, you probably want to see it actually complete. And we can go up to here and, wait, did I do the right thing? Let me get rid of the breakpoint, continue running it. I want to prove that it actually works, but let's see, let's try again. Okay. Well, you saw it running in the debugger. Also, it gives you a bash, so you can actually commit changes. So I can run git diff, yeah, or git status. I haven't made any changes yet, so there's nothing to commit. So then I can commit work, and then if I have to run and I go to another machine and open up a browser, all my work is still there. So I think that's an interesting look at what the future may hold. And then, you know, if you remember Whitney Houston, she said that children are our future. And so if you want to understand the future program, we should look at what we're building for children. How many of you here have seen Scratch? Is anyone? Okay, a few of you. I really love this environment. This is a programming environment that's geared towards children, but you should try it out because you'll find that it has some very powerful concepts built into it. So what I will do is create a new project. And it provides a very visual, immediate way of writing code. So for example, you have these sprites, and you can, there's a couple of really cool things. I'm so excited about it, I can't even decide what to say next. So for example, you have events, right? So I can do when key pressed, I can configure this. Let's say up arrow, we want to change the position. Change X or Y by, we want to change. I guess up arrow, we should change Y, shouldn't we? So, you know, X being this way, Y being this way. And then I'm going to duplicate this. And what's interesting is that this works on a very message-based concurrent manner. So you have these multiple little concurrent programs that all work together and can send messages to each other. So we'll change Y by negative 10, and then I'm going to the other thing I should mention is this all compiles down to JavaScript, because I think another thing as we're learning is that, you know, like it or not, JavaScript may be the key language in our future. I know not everyone's happy about that. Oops. So change X by 10. Okay. So now I can start this program, and using my arrow keys, I can move this little person around. And then I can also add more sprites. So let's add another sprite. Let's add a basketball. And what's cool is that the basketball gets its own script. So in sort of an object-oriented way, each program has its own data and its own set of functionality. And I can do like I can. So when the green flag is kicked, that means we start the program. We have control flows, so I can do a forever loop. And if it senses, so sensing is really cool. So forever if, control flow. If it's touching the other sprite, we want to play a sound. And what sound? Let's record something. I hope this works. Allow. Ouch. Is it work? Ouch. Okay, I don't know if that worked, but we'll just give it a shot. And here, let's move this side and hit that. So when we do that, okay, that's not working, but let's do something else where we can see that it's actually doing something. So we'll move 10 steps. So let's try that. See that? So in a few small little things, I've created a little game, right? Or you could create a game. So my son is 8. He's built several games using this environment. But you could imagine the power of this environment if you connected it to things like Excel or your database. Like, people who don't have formal backgrounds in programming might be able to write the types of scripts that help you automate your daily life. So I'm a real big fan of Scratch. I think that things like that might be a big part of our future. Another thing that's really big these days is conversations. If you saw or were at Build, Microsoft talked a lot about their bot framework. This is actually something that we've been doing at GitHub for a while in the context of the work environment. So this is Slack, and within our Slack at GitHub, we have something called Hubot. And Hubot is an open source project. You can go to hubot.github.com. And he's this friendly little yellow robot, but he's got a bit of an attitude problem. For example, if you say, "You suck," he will respond, "Come at me, bro." But mostly we do things like, we add location data to it. So PMN is Paul Nakata. He's my coworker who's here with me in Peru. And you can see that, oh yeah, Hubot told me he's here. Good. I just need to find him. And then we connected it to all the other services. So Wolfram is a service that you can ask questions. So Wolf me the distance from Lima, Peru to Bellevue, Washington. Bellevue is where I live. And we'll see that it's thinking, 7,974 kilometers. Hubot is coffee script based, so you can write, or JavaScript based, you can write your own commands. So I did not write this one, but Paul, I think, wrote a hack me command. So when you need some encouragement, you can run this command. And then, it's not all fun and games. We actually do work here. So for example, the Windows app, the GitHub desktop for Windows, I can deploy a branch to, for example, our lab, so that I can test it out. I'm not actually going to run this because, A, there's no branch foo. But if I hit that, it would actually look for a branch foo of our Windows repository, try to push it to a lab, and then I could try it out. And what's really cool about that, about the chat interface, is that someone else who's new to my team, reading the chat transcripts, can look at that and be like, oh, that's how you deploy. Because if I'm using software only on my machine, like, I'd have to record a session for anyone else to learn what I'm doing. But by going through a chat interface kind of in a semi-public setting, I'm teaching everyone I work with how to do this stuff. All right. But I think, this is kind of like chat in a textual work environment. I think Microsoft is working a lot on bringing chat more to a consumer market. And so I'm hoping the sound works here. Let's test this out. But if you have a Windows 10 machine, you actually already have Cortana. And so if you hit Windows C, this brings up Cortana. She's listening. So I'll say, "Cortana, do you like Obama?" And Cortana is ignoring me. I think she's upset. OK, let's try it again.
Cortana, do you like Obama?
Cortana, are you listening? Okay. I swear this worked this morning. One more try.
Cortana, do you like Obama?
You know, I... What? Could be the network. I'm connected. Okay. Well, we'll just have to skip it. You can ask Cortana, who is the coolest person in the world? And she'll say you, no matter who you are. So you can tell her to tell me a joke, and she'll tell you a joke. Not very good ones. And then if you ask her to translate that joke to Spanish, she then brings up the Google Translate or Microsoft Translate, but she doesn't translate the joke. So she's not quite to the point where you can, you know, get the context of the previous thing and have the next thing relate to that, that sort of next level of natural language processing. But you can see that kind of thing is coming. This is sort of one future way we'll interact with computers. All right. So let's go back to my slides. Let's see. Oh, good. All right, so I gave you some demos that show kind of what's coming in the future, right? You know, more intelligent interfaces, more fluid interfaces, more natural interfaces. What about the far future? Now, the stuff I'm going to talk about next is highly theoretical, and a lot of it has no actual application to your daily lives, but I just found it interesting, and I thought I'd share it. Because one of the questions I asked is, okay, we know that Moore's law is kind of, well, for you guys, taking computing like this, but there is a fundamental limit to Moore's law, right? We can only cram so many transistors on a chip. Once you get to the atomic level, quantum mechanical effects start to cause interference. And there might be other ways we can continue Moore's law, for example, quantum computing. If you want to know more about quantum computing, you can ask the Prime Minister of Canada, and he'll tell you. But there are theoretical maximum computational limits. So for example, there's something called Bremerman's limit. So this is Bremerman. He's a physicist or a computer scientist, or kind of a hodgepodge of those. So for example, if you had a computer that was the entire mass of the Earth, instead of cloud computing, we're talking planetary computing, and if that computer was operating at the Bremerman's limit, it could do 10 to the 75 mathematical computations per second. That is a number that's so large it's hard to imagine. But even at that rate, it's going to take you 10 to the 72 years to crack a 512-bit key, encryption key. But one interesting criticism of this limit is that it doesn't take into consideration quantum computing, which can do those 10 to 72 calculations perhaps in parallel. So there's this other theorem that sort of looks at, that does factor in quantum mechanics effects and looks at, based on, I'm forgetting the theorem, but anyways, based on principles of quantum mechanics and relativity, this is the max number of operations per second per joule of energy. So since the universe has a finite amount of energy, as far as we know, there's a finite amount of computing power. But rather than look at raw computing, Bekenstein looked at storage instead of computation. So he calculated the upper limit of information we can store in a finite space with finite energy. And we're, keep in mind, we're nowhere near this limit. We have a lot of room to grow as a species. But a consequence of that is that there is a limit to the amount of information needed to, for example, fully describe a brain. And when I say fully describe, I mean to the quantum level, all the quantum states of every atom, every particle in that brain, there's a finite limit. Now, that number is, again, incomprehensibly large. But the point there is that, that's the theoretical upper bound, but there may be some number where we can have computers that can completely and fully simulate a human brain somewhere down the road. And then there's some theoretical ways that we might actually come close to these limits. And these are like super speculative, right? So our descendants may be able to create a neutron star, or brown dwarf, that could be used as a giant data storage device. Like, for example, it might be possible to use a black hole as a data storage device. So remember, forget planetary computing, now we're in the black hole computing or black hole storage. But in order to make this happen, future humans will have to figure out if there's this theorem or this paradox called the black hole information paradox, where black holes appear to destroy information, but that's a paradox because supposedly information can't be destroyed. And you know, depending on if we can extract information out of a black hole, you know, our descendants may be able to use an entire black hole as a computing device, a data storage device. That's pretty crazy stuff. But for now, we have an amazing and bright future to go invent, because we here, you all in this room, we're the ones who are going to invent the future, because that's the only way we can predict it, is by inventing it. So let's go build it. Thank you very much.